Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. This afternoon, one of the laymen who was here today for a meal offering offered to give me a massage, and he's a really good masseur, and so it's like, it's over 2 hours, and I felt, and it was sitting meditation. Wow, I feel so good. And then so I think, it's a feeling, the body relaxed, comfortable, at ease, and then thinking, well, that's, it's actually why we, the body feeling at ease is one, but then, that's also our Dhamma practice is for making the mind feel at ease, and just to feel comfortable, having the mind, the heart, releasing, relaxing, settling, and that's why we practice, and what the purpose of the practice is, so that and in the same way that it takes the working, having a good massage and working all the various areas of the body and relaxing them. It's the similarly with the training the mind, the heart, working with it. It takes a whole bunch of different aspects and qualities in order for it to really settle and experience this sense of ease. And that's why many of the, the teachings of the Buddha are not just, well, just do one thing, just be mindful, or just be wise, or just be patient. There's all these different qualities that we need to be attending to and getting into balance. So, of course, one of the more common sets of teachings that the Buddha gives is spiritual faculties, the indriyas, faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom, sandha, sila, sati, samadhi, panya. These are qualities to be working on and cultivating, and one can look at it as qualities to be working on in a linear way, in the sense that first you lay a foundation for sense of faith, confidence, trust. And when one does that, then of course when there's some energy and effort arises, you know, as we put forth that effort and energy, then the mindfulness, awareness, attention needs to be cared for. And as these qualities start to gain momentum, then the mind and the heart will settle, will become more composed, will become more still, and with that as a foundation and a basis, and wisdom, discernment, understanding arises. And that's sort of looking at it from a linear perspective. And it has a certain validity to it, but I don't think that's the whole picture. Because there's also the qualities of balancing that need to be attended to, and a sense of faith and wisdom needing to be informing each other, so that these are, say, the first quality and the last quality are, we have to learn how to have those inform each other, support each other, nourish each other, because that sense of your faith needs to be informed by wisdom and discernment. Otherwise, it's just blindly believing something, or getting all, say, excited and enthusiastic faith, but not really being tempered by reflection, investigation, and discernment. Similarly, the wisdom faculty has to be tempered with faith and confidence and trust, because you can't just be analyzing and logically pounding out a system of spiritual practice through the intellect. It just doesn't work. It's not satisfying. It doesn't uplift and brighten the mind. Even if you're, you know, as intelligent as one can be, if one's just relying on that intelligence and intellect, the rationality, then it doesn't go very deep. It's pretty superficial, pretty surface. And the aspects of energy, effort, those need to be, have a certain stillness and composure, balancing them, because the effort is, and energy is, it can be, it can be agitating, or be even, how do you say, on a certain level, sort of addictive, and there's in that sense of, I've got to do more. I got to push myself. I got to keep pushing. Got to put more energy in. If I get more, that sort of the more I do, the more I'll achieve. Well, not really. That isn't necessarily how it works at all. Because sometimes the more effort we put in, the more frantic and agitated the mind actually becomes, so that it needs to have this quality of settling and stilling, that concentration element, samadhi, that firm establishing of the mind as a balance and as a support. They have to feed each other. And and also that if we're constantly just trying to still the mind, compose the mind, settle the mind, without applying some effort and energy with it, then it oftentimes tends to dullness and a kind of turgid quality in the mind. It just becomes kind of sludgy. I keep getting that image. I'll keep focusing the mind and one pointing the mind and making the mind more and more still, and then it just sort of sinks into this kind of puddle of quicksand. It isn't really bright. It needs that need, and there needs to be some energy in the system. There needs to be some effort, but it needs to be balancing. You need to be attuning these different qualities. And of course, that's what mindfulness is for. That mindfulness, awareness, attention. It's checking in on what am I experiencing? Is it useful? Is it beneficial? Is it in line with the Dhamma? Mindfulness isn't global awareness. Non-discriminating attention. It's got work to do. And it needs to be alert. It needs to be attentive. But then with these different qualities, of faith, of confidence, of wisdom, discernment, of effort and energy, of stillness and composure, and mindfulness working together, functioning together. And then it's a felt sense of a release from dukkha, a release from that sense of stress, discontent, dissatisfaction, dis-ease, in the same way that I was, stimulated that thought having a massage in the body, feeling really relaxed and light, and it's a felt sense of ease. And so similarly, in the mind, the heart, there's this very that sense of ease and freedom from dukkha. And of course, the Buddha says over and over again, I teach only two things, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha, and the ending of dukkha. So dukkha as the whole spectrum of dis-ease, discontent, stress, and the ending, cessation of dukkha, is the experience of well-being, of ease, the heart experiencing a lightness and a sense of, there's a certain radiance there. It's bright. And these are experiences that we have to turn our attention to and need to take an interest. How do we, it's not sort of how do I make that, how do I make myself get that, but what do I do in order to support the experience of a sense of ease and well-being, of freedom from dukkha. And that's, you know, in the spiritual faculties are a good parameters and reminders, but that's also one set of teachings that the Buddha gives, and there it's a good boundary, a good start. But in reality, there's, you know, of course, there's many different ways to nurture and support that sense of well-being and growth in Dhamma. And it's also something that we need to be considering, not just, you know, what do I do in meditation so that I feel better, but also what do I do in my daily life so that I feel a sense of ease and well-being. How do I integrate this into my life, and whether it's in the monastery or whether it's in the world, in society with job and family, these are, you know, what qualities are helpful. And of course there's really an endless number of things to point to, but I think there's some pretty recurrent or things that consistently come up in when we're hearing how, you know, teachers advise their people who are interested in Dhamma, and those aspects of you know, certainly the say the precepts, that's a really lays a really firm foundation in how we guide our daily life. And those precepts, not just in a restricting, oh, I've got to force myself into this mode of giving up certain behaviors, but it's looking at what is it that really makes me feel good, and what makes others feel good? Is that, and so that commitment to non-harming, not taking the life of any living creature. Is that sense of non-harming, that sense of threatening the well-being of some other of the life form. That and so when we steep ourselves in that, it feels good. Same with that, not taking what isn't given, and sort of steeping ourselves in that sense of commitment to honesty, a commitment to respecting the belongings of others, and that sense of, especially when we think of trust, and I think because oftentimes it, like with and I used it as a word like faith, confidence, trust, they're kind of similar qualities. But then when for ourselves, how do we trust ourselves? How do we have faith in ourselves? Well, it's that commitment to honesty, that commitment to respect. And that And again, that gives a certain strength within the heart. It's really supportive in our practice. And you know, so that when you're reflecting on the precepts in that way, and again, like with that precept around relationship and sexual relationships. I mean, that's how it's overtly with that, but it's also how we relate to each other in a respectful way, so that there's trust in our relationships with each other. That lays a foundation for ourselves to experience this sense of trust and confidence. That's actually something that the Buddha points to as a benefit of having kept the precepts and forming a basis of integrity with our actions of body and speech. There is a confidence when we go into different assemblies of people, when we interact with other people, and whether it's a small number or a large number, whether they're people of have some authority in the society, if there are people who don't, but there's a sense of confidence that is underneath our relationships and interactions with other people, and that's again there's a sense of ease, so that when we engage with others, then there's this sense of think of Ajahn Chah as probably one of the foremost examples of that, and just as being at ease with whatever, whether it's people who were farmers and whether they were merchants, whether they were military, whether they were business people, there's just this ease and straightforwardness, and I think, so it comes from the precepts form that foundation. Is something the Buddha points to as a benefit that arises. So this sense of and certainly with the third precept around speech, and when we are committed to truth and again that non-harming, because it's not there needs to be some wise application of how we relate, because there's that right speech is truthful speech, but also not using harsh speech, not gossiping, tale-bearing, and then not wasting our energy in just frivolous and frivolous speech is a good word. In the scriptural language, the word that is translated as physical frivolous speech, it's is very illustrative of what the Buddha is pointing to. It's like onomatopoeic, in that is sampapalapa, and is the word that's used. And so you can just hear somebody babbling on, just talking about nothing. Sampapalapa, and that's a so much of speech is not really necessary, not useful, not beneficial, and it's more helpful to, rather than distracting ourselves and distracting others with frivolous speech, then having a settled quality inside. There's an ease that comes from that. This commitment to the precepts, again, not because it's we're afraid of some punishment or that there's or that there's some sort of punitive aspect to the transgressing precepts. It feels much better to be within those bounds of the precepts. It's for our cessation of suffering and experiencing that sense of ease and well-being. And the last precept refraining from intoxicants of various kinds is just to keep the mind as clear as possible. We already have, say, the intoxicating habits of greed, hatred, and delusion, and all of its ramifications, so that to refrain from the various kinds of substances that can intoxicate the mind as well and create more dullness. Yeah, so it's just that commitment to clarity. So there's, and we see what, as we continue with that and continue to refine that commitment to clarity, to truth, to well-being, then the Buddha's teachings just keep supporting and help us to refine that. There's other aspects of, say, qualities of heart, qualities of being that are essential or helpful in our spiritual quest. As I might say, think, like a quality of respect, that sense of being respectful. Of course, the first person to be respectful towards is towards ourselves. You think of what is it that would really prevent me from doing something unskillful or harmful, and you realize there's a respect towards oneself. Which I really don't want to engage in something that is hurtful, harmful, create suffering, because that's not what I want. It's not how I would want to be, what I want to experience. So then there's this, and respecting oneself, not wanting to bring that in into one's heart, not wanting to bring that into one's being, because one respects oneself. It's nurturing anger and ill will, nurturing this kind of greed that is ends up being kind of selfish and self-centered. We say, that's really that isn't actually respecting myself. I deserve better than that. And it's you know, just that simple reflection. So that respect, and then saying, "Well, what are the things that are worthy of respect? What can I give my respect to?" Of course, one respects oneself, but then, what are things that are worthy of respect? This, certainly, for a Buddhist, then, say the refuges of Buddhism and Sangha. Those are things that are worthy of respect. They embody or exemplify the qualities that we ourselves want to, that we aspire to. The Buddha as the prime example of an awakened being, an enlightened being, that one who has completely freed the heart. That's really worthy of respect. The Dhamma, the teachings, that lay out a path of practice and training that fully give us the possibility of understanding and liberation ourselves. That's really worthy of respect. And Sangha, those who practice well, and that's when we do the chanting as we did tonight. We chant the qualities of Sangha, and sense of Supatipanno is one who practices well, one who practices directly, one who practices insightfully, one who practices with integrity. Those are the qualities of Sangha, those that is worthy of respect. And it's not just, say, having robes and taking a formal ordination, because when we ordain, I mean, our defilements ordain with us. So it's about practicing, it's about training, and that's whoever takes on the practice fully and experiences the fruits of practice. And let's say in the chant that we do. I mean, this is a traditional chant that goes back to the time of the Buddha, when the Buddha spoke of the qualities of Sangha. Sangha is refuge, Sangha is an object of veneration. These were the qualities of Sangha. Supatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho. And it was all the way through. And I can't remember exactly how it's the eight individuals, four kinds of beings. That sort of those who experience the path and the fruit of the practice. That's what it's pointing to. How's it? I've been chanting this stuff for years. You forget these things. The four pairs. Yeah, that's. I mean, it's the four pairs, the eight kinds of noble beings, and that these are the Blessed One's disciples, and that's four pairs are the path and fruit, the path of practice, the fruit of the practice, stream enterer, once returner, non returner, arahant, and so it's. This is the Sangha of the Buddha's noble disciples, and just knowing that there are these fruits of practice, it's worthy of respect. So this quality, respect, is a quality that nurtures and supports our practice. Of course, another quality that is very essential for our practice, and Ajahn Chah would emphasize it over and over again, patience, just being willing to be patient. We want to experience the fruits of practice immediately. We want to gain knowledge and understanding immediately. We want to get it quickly, and that's understandable. But it's also, again, in a sense, it's a process that we have to trust, and we have to get a feeling for that confidence in this process of training. And it's sort of where Ajahn Chah uses that image or simile of being patient and diligent in putting in the causes and conditions. It's like planting a tree. You have to dig a hole for the tree to be planted. You get the right mixture of earth and dirt, and you have fertilizer that you put in. You water it regularly, and depending on the kind of tree it is, it's going to give fruit in a different way. It doesn't take very long for, like planting chili peppers and some, I don't know, it doesn't take very long, so probably a matter of months or so, or say like tomatoes. It's like a few months and they're already giving, you plant it and they're tomatoes. Whereas you plant an apple tree or like a coconut tree, it takes ages before your coconuts actually sort of show up. But so you just have to be patient with the process. And with that same with ourselves. We don't really know what kind of person we are. So we just have to, some people experience the fruits of the practice slowly, some people experience it quickly. But the process of cultivation and development and balancing all these different faculties, that's very, very similar. And the fruits of the practice come. It's the nature of this Dhamma. The Buddha was extremely confident in the efficacy of his path, and to the point where he said, it's not that you have to believe in him. He said, here's the tools, here's the path, here's the practice, and do it and the fruits will appear. And that's immensely confident and assured in that this is the way it works. This is the way the human condition is. There is this suffering. There is this possibility of freedom from suffering. This is the way to do it. Go and do it. It's not saying the Buddha's not going to do it for us, and he's not. It doesn't matter to him whether anybody else does it. He's already freed from suffering. And same with the great teachers. They know for themselves what the path of practice is. They've experienced the fruits of it, and they encourage, they teach, they set examples. But if people don't do it, don't follow the path, and don't practice, it's not a source of suffering for them. It's something that is the person themselves is missing out on an opportunity. So that too, that sense of being patient with the practice, being patient with the conditions of our life, because it's oftentimes with it, like patience is just, you know, putting up with something unpleasant until it's over. But it's also being patient, just being willing to be present with. And it, because sometimes like being patient with happiness or ease, like we start to feel a sense of ease and happiness, and it's easy to start to drift or to say, oh, I'm getting somewhere now, here I am. But you need to be patient with even the feeling of happiness and peace, because it's important to let that settle and let that unfold into a deeper understanding, a deeper a deeper drawing close to truth, drawing close to a freedom of heart. And it's so easy sometimes to start to feel peaceful or happy and say, oh, now I got somewhere, now I'll go do something else. And this is not being patient with it, to let it really unfold. And so that these qualities of respect, patience, that commitment to integrity, and a commitment to the process of the path, and recognizing that there are all many different factors that need to come together: faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, wisdom. These need to be balanced. They need to work together. So that learning how to implement and live this path in our daily life, in the circumstances that we're in, and again, whether it's on the cushion in meditation or doing on our walking meditation paths, or when we have responsibilities and duties, these are the qualities that give us the opportunity to experience a freedom from suffering, and to experience that peace and well-being that the Dhamma can give us. So I'll offer that for reflection this evening.